Hello, good evening, welcome. My name is Tim Besley. I'm the director of the Suntory Toyota International Centers for Economics and Related Disciplines at the LSE. And this is the third in our series of 25th anniversary lectures. As many of you will know, the founding chairman of STICKERD was Professor Michio Morishima. Unfortunately, he's not able to be here this evening, but we're delighted to have Mrs. Morishima in the audience, and I'm sure that she'll join us, you'll join me in conveying to her our very best wishes to Michio. Our speaker this evening is Nick Stern, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome him back to the LSE. Nick's enjoyed a distinguished career in academic life and now in public life. He was educated at Cambridge and took his DPhil from Oxford, where he was subsequently a fellow of St. Catherine's College. After that, he served as Professor of Economics at the University of Warwick before moving to the LSE in 1986. While at the school, Nick was the Sir John Hicks Professor of Economics and subsequently School Professor of Economics. He was also chairman of STICKERD, which thrived under his leadership. His contributions lie mainly in the field of public economics and development economics. Among the highlights, I'd mention his path-breaking work on public goods with Tony Atkinson and his research which led to his book with Christopher Bliss on Palanpur, a village in northern India, which he subsequently developed with generations of LSE PhD students and also with Jean Drez. His academic work has earned him numerous honors, including a fellowship of the Econometric Society and of the British Academy. Nick's held three distinguished positions in public life, at least three that I can name. First, he served as chief economist at the EBRD, followed by his stint as chief economist and senior vice president at the World Bank. He's currently second permanent secretary at Her Majesty's Treasury, where he's also head of the, I'm glad to say, ever-expanding Government Economic Service. Nick personifies the best traditions of STICKERD and the LSE more generally, to understand the world and then to put these ideas to practical use. Nick's topic tonight is inclusion, changing preferences and public policy, and he'll be examining the relations of inclusion and empowerment to public policy and in particular the challenge of analyzing and formulating public policy in the context of changing pleasures, preferences. Nick, it gives me great pleasure to welcome you back to the LSE this evening, and we very much look forward to your lecture.
Thank you very much, Tim. Just at the beginning, I won't stay on a sad note very long, but we lost one of the great minds in public economics in the early hours of Saturday morning when Jean-Jacques Lafont died in Toulouse. And I'd just like to dedicate what I have to say to him. He was a great man and a great friend and one of the world's great economists. It's lovely to be back here. I think that if you woke me up in the middle of the night when I was a bit bleary-eyed and said, what do you do, what's your excuse? I would have said, well, I try to teach economics at the LSE. And if you asked me where my anchor is, as it were, that's it, it's my intellectual home. And I'm very happy that the professors of economics invited me to be a visiting professor here. So when people say, by way of introduction, by way of excusing some stupid thing I've said, he was a professor of economics at the LSE. I say I am a professor of economics at the LSE. And it's lovely to be back in STICKERD because I think that the years that I spent in STICKERD were probably the most intellectually happy and productive period of my life. Extraordinary colleagues, and some of them have been lecturing to you in this series of lectures. And it's wonderful to see STICKERD doing so well and in such good hands. So it's a real pleasure to be back. Now, what I'm going to try to do today is to actually talk about something that's probably too difficult for me and probably too difficult for many of you, but I'm not sure it won't be too difficult for all of you. And that is public policy when preferences change. I've come to believe that working in development for the best part of my adult life, at least since the 60s, that this is a huge part of the story. I think there are some things in economics where changing preferences are not central. I suspect for some parts, not all, of the theory of taxation, say, we can say a great deal on the assumption of constant preferences, which is actually important and valuable. But I think they're very important parts of the subject including actually other parts of the theory of taxation, where we have to embrace the idea that preferences may change. Now, for many in economics, they say, well, you're jumping ship, you're throwing away the basic foundations of our subject. Just think of what we teach people in the first year of microeconomics. Essentially, it's deriving the consequences of constant preferences, which is at the heart of demand and supply theory and the theory of behavior. But I'm not asking in anything that comes later in what I have to say to throw any of that away. I think it is actually a vital foundation, an extraordinarily rich body of thought that served us extremely well and will serve us extremely well. But what I am saying is that for much of what we do, we have to go beyond that as well. And what I want to talk about is some of the difficulties of doing that. Now, in order to motivate what I have to say, I'm going to say something at the beginning about the way in which the world has changed. Because it's the way in which the world has changed which actually points to what I think is important here in the challenge of changing preferences. So let me begin with that. Now, I hope that you've got some tables in front of you, and I'm going to refer at some point to those numbers in the tables. So the structure of what I'm going to say looks like this. First, using a few numbers, I'll argue that development is about fundamental changes in ways of life, and it's not about simply growth through the expansion of capital, whether it be physical or human. That is part of the story, but I think it's in some ways quite a superficial part of the story. That'll lead me to suggesting a particular strategy for development, which I've been arguing elsewhere, based on two pillars: an investment climate for growth, investment obviously, and employment, and secondly, empowering and investing in people. And both of these will be both of these strategies for growth, which I've argued in the World Bank and other places, indeed it forms now part of the strategy of the World Bank, those two pillars depend enormously on institutions, governance, and behavior. And what I'll do today is focus not so much on the first pillar of the investment climate, which I've argued about elsewhere, but talk about the second pillar, which is promoting empowerment, participation, and inclusion. Empowerment, participation, and inclusion are closely related topics, but I'll comment briefly that they're not exactly the same topics. But those interested in empowerment, participation, and inclusion are usually interested in very similar things and very similar policies. That'll take me to the dynamics of preferences, and I'll make some concluding remarks on where that points in the theory of public policy. So let's start with the development as a process of change. And what I will do is, in this part, these next three or four slides, also refer to the tables which you have in front of you. So the first of the tables, and I should say that these tables come from a book which will be published by MIT Press sometime around the end of this year, the beginning of next, which was based on some lectures which I gave in Munich about a year and a half ago. And it's a book prepared with two collaborators at the World Bank, Jean-Jacques Dettier and Halsey Rogers. Now, if we look at the first of these tables, table one, you will see that in all the countries of the developing world, or all the major parts of the developing world, quite dramatic changes in education and health. If you look at the two tables, I haven't got time to dwell on the numbers, but you will find that school enrollment in sub-Saharan Africa, from the very first page, bottom row, school enrollment in sub-Saharan Africa rose from just about 51 in 1970, just over a half, to 79% in 2000. And similarly, you see falls in illiteracy, both for females and for males. If you look at the next page, you get corresponding figures for health, and you'll see strongly declining fertility rates around the world, dramatic declines in fertility rates over 30 years in East Asia and the Pacifics. That's a quite extraordinary fall. That really is economic development fast forward, to see in a space of 30 years, East Asia births per woman go down from 5.72 to 2.12. That's the first line on table 1-2. There's a, please excuse me for a typo, where it says Source Chen and Revalian, it should actually say Africa. That's not a typo, that's some of the gremlins that come when you move things around in Excel and so on. But Source Channel Rebellion should read Africa. So you have had quite extraordinary improvement on some dimensions, including in sub-Saharan Africa. And I start with that for two reasons, that development does take place, development is on a number of dimensions, that's the first reason, but also to contrast those health and education experiences with income, which I'll talk about in just a moment. If you go on to table two, you will see corresponding figures on some dimensions here. I've just taken the health dimension over a period of nearly 200 years. Like most people in this area, I'm dependent on the figures of Angus Maddison. I sometimes wonder where Angus Maddison got them from, but all the same, we're all dependent on the same source. And there you see that from 1820 to 1950, if you say just looked at life expectancy in developing countries, you'd see only modest changes. So 1820 to 1900, I should say, you see modest changes, and then in the last century, it started to pick up. And in the last 50 years, we've seen very strong changes. So in these education and health dimensions, the story of development is one of quite remarkable change, and what I'm arguing is particularly in the last 50 years. Now, let me turn to income, because I deliberately started with education and health, where changes have been very strong. In income, also very strong changes, but now it's much more patchy, and sub-Saharan Africa is essentially left out. So if you could look at table three, you will see that the world as a whole grew very strongly in the quarter of a century or so after the Second World War, particularly driven by the growth of the rich countries. But the quarter century since then, the quarter century since the mid-1970s, is really the story of growth in Asia outside Japan, particularly in China. So within the last 50 years, striking periods of growth, powerful for the rich countries in the first 25 years following the Second World War, but as it were, charge being taken up by East Asia, particularly China, in the last 25 years or so. Africa, in terms of income per capita, did not do too badly in the 25 years after the Second World War, but has hardly moved in terms of income per capita in the last 25 years. So there is a different story when we look at education and health on the one hand and income on the other. But a story, if you're looking at development as a whole, which is in many ways a story of success, except for the last 25 years or so on the income front in sub-Saharan Africa. And I have indeed rushed here from Tony Blair's Commission for Africa, which he has called, and which will be the lead story of the G8 presidency of the UK next year. And 15 commissioners for Africa met this afternoon trying to get their minds around the challenge of development in Africa. And as I was telling Tim before we started, much of my next year will be spent working on the challenge of Africa for the Commission for Africa. I thought I'd stop travelling when I came back from the World Bank, but I learned that you never make assumptions about what's going to happen next. So that's, as it were, a very quick run through some of the experience of development. Now, many people first talk about development when many people first turn to income poverty when they talk about development, and I very deliberately didn't start that way. But if you do turn to income poverty, you get a very striking story, which really comes out of the kinds of numbers I've just been looking at. I don't know how easy that is to read, but basically the story in the left-hand part of this graph is of the share of people living on less than $1 a day across the developing world, particularly South Asia and East Asia, where of course the biggest populations are, falling fairly strongly for the last 20 years, but not in Africa. In Africa, it's been rising. So there's a very distinctive difference in experience there. You can see that in the block on the right-hand side, which essentially shows the number of people on less than $1 a day, which quite remarkably has been falling in the last 20 years. It hadn't fallen since 1820. It started to fall around 1980. But that fall is in very large measure from China. In the early part of the 1980s, with the move from the commune system to the household responsibility system in China, you saw a rapid rise in agricultural productivity and the most important poverty event in human history, when 200 or 300 million people moved out of poverty. So the big kicker on this fall in poverty over the last 20 years in absolute numbers is what happened in China, particularly what happened to China in the early part of the 1980s. So that's a very strong story there. But you can see, and this is the middle part over here, a rising numbers and a rising share of Africans living under $1 a day. So that actually brings out the story of income growth, which I was telling in some of the earlier numbers. So that very briefly is a snapshot of some aspects of experience. Now let's look at what lies behind some of these stories. Well, first, I think that you cannot, and I'll just give one or two numbers in just a minute to illustrate this, that you cannot see development as just an expansion of income from capital accumulation, whether it be human capital or physical capital. And secondly, what's going on underneath the story, the dramatic changes in structures of economies, populations and societies, cannot really be described very effectively by the standard tools that we use in simple models of growth. We have to deal with institutional change, sectoral change, demographic change, the role of women in society, and so on. So let me very briefly complete what I have to say about development as a process of change by drawing out, and I won't go through great detail here, I'll just refer you to the tables. Table 6 looks at periods of 15 years or more of 5% per annum growth rates. Now, why have I done that in income per capita? Why have I done that? Well, just roughly, if you grow at 5% per annum for 15 years, you double your income per capita, and that, I think, would be seen as a remarkable change by anybody's standards. Well, the first thing I want to note here is that Table 6, which records those experiences, is a table with quite a lot of examples in it. There are periods of 15%, there are periods of 15 years with 5% or so growth rates in economic history around the world. It's not that uncommon. What's much less common is that for those periods to be sustained over long periods, over much longer periods of time than that. So when we're talking about growth theory, and we're talking about growth theory in relation to growth experience, we should be thinking about why it is that you get some of these periods of growth coming for these reasonably extended periods, why it is that they don't last all that long, and not about what are the properties of steady state growth. I think the evidence should lead us elsewhere when we're trying to understand what happens in growth. It should be about spurts in growth, why they happen, why they stop, how they can be sustained, rather than the long run steady state, which is so much an attraction, or has attracted, modern growth theories. It was Nicky Calder, I think, who did the damage when he published his paper on stylized facts in the late 1950s, where he spoke about the steadiness of long-run growth. He was writing in the middle of that rather special period that I referred to, the 25 years after the Second World War. They were certainly stylized, but they were certainly not facts about the economy as a whole and its prospects. So that's illustrated in Table 6. Table 7 refers briefly to the massive changes in the structure of economies. You'll see, table 6 is the fits and starts. Table 7 is the structure of the economies, where I draw attention to the remarkable fall in the share of the population in agriculture in low-income countries over the last 40 years, falling from around a half to around a quarter. That's dramatic structural change. And if you go to Table 8, I've just assembled a few obvious numbers, again from Angus Maddison, on the whole process of integration of economies into the world. And you'll see again that these last years have been quite remarkable in terms of the integration of economies into the world. So what I want to argue here then is that growth is about understanding bursts of growth, and that growth and development is about understanding how structures change in the process, economic, social, demographic, and so on. Now, I'm not going to go into detail on here. I've been trying to flog a strategy for development around the world over the last 3 or 4 years, which is of a rather simple kind. It's the two-pillar strategy I referred to earlier on, where the first part of the story is trying to build an investment climate in which people can take entrepreneurial and effective decisions. And the second is the main thing that I want to talk about today, which is empowering poor people and promoting participation in development. Both elements or pillars of that strategy place governance, institutions and behaviour at their heart. And we have, with colleagues at the World Bank, been working quite hard on actually translating that story into real direction for gathering of data and the formulation of policy. Now, I said that I wouldn't dwell on the investment climate. That's just the one slide I've got on the investment climate, because it's the second pillar that I want to focus attention on here. The story then is that we define investment climate in terms of the macro and openness, the general boring standard economic policies, extremely important nonetheless, even though they're now regarded, I hope, as boring. Boring in the sense of obviously clear that unless you do this, you're going to screw up. Second is the infrastructure, and the third is governance and institutions. And we have, with the partners at the World Bank, been gathering data on these issues over the last 4 or 5 years quite intensively. And we ask people questions: how long does it take to get goods through customs? How often are you visited by members of the local authorities? How much do you have to pay them to go away? How much is how often is your electricity on? And so on, specific quantitative measures of the investment climate which allow us to look at its role in economic growth and relate those particular measures to economic activity. But as I said, that's not my main part of the story here, and I want to turn to the second pillar. Now, it's here that we start to get into some things that are probably a bit too difficult for us, but I'll wallow around in these things that are a bit too difficult for us for much of the remainder of what I have to say, and try to bring out some of the intellectual challenges. First, what does empowerment mean? Well, yes, indeed, what does empowerment mean? It's a hard question. But crudely speaking, we try to understand it, and I'll spend a moment or two on this issue, in terms of control over one's own life. In a very, very narrow sense in which economists deal with it, it's the kind of choice set that you talk about, the set over which you make your choices. But that's a much too narrow view, and I'll try to expand on that view in as we go along in the next two or three the next two or three slides. Now, as an example of what gaining control over your own life might mean, I've just given four things here. Management of schools and water projects. There are a lot of examples now of how schools and irrigation projects work much better if communities are directly involved. There are examples around the world, and you can see it from the most recent World Development Report, Making Services Work for Poor People, of how much better schools work when parents are directly involved and the community is directly involved in their running. How much better irrigation systems work when farmers are directly involved in the allocation of water. We know from the work of De Soto and others how dramatic improvements can be when security of property rights in slums or for smallholders are established. Health status is clearly something which, without health, then is a dramatic loss of control over your own life. These are the kinds of examples of what empowerment means. It is also not just a construct of economists or social scientists wanting to do something new. If you ask poor people what their poverty means to them, they come back very strongly in terms of ideas of empowerment. And again, I refer you to another World Bank study, which is Voices of the Poor, in which they asked poor people to define their poverty. They had about 60,000 people in 60 countries. As ever with the World Bank, things are done on a grand scale. But I think the answers that came out of that, I think, do point us to people defining for themselves empowerment as central to their own meaning of what poverty is and their own understanding of poverty. Now, let me point to, let me try to give a little more structure to what empowerment might mean, or what the constraints on empowerment might mean. The first of these is individual endowments, whether it be physical or human capital. That's absolutely standard. I spoke of the choice set earlier when I first introduced it, and that must be part of the story. But I think there are all kinds of other constraints here. There are the external constraints associated with family, social, and cultural political context. And they place very powerful constraints on what an individual believes to be the kinds of things that she or he can control. And further, and these are some things which I've learnt about really from anthropologists rather than from economists or other parts of the social sciences, is the internal constraints, or what Apadurai calls the lack of a capacity to aspire. So in other words, people place controls on themselves directly associated with what they believe they can or should try to do. And I believe that in many circumstances, those kinds of constraints are very powerful. And we'll come back to some examples on that. So that's illustrated diagrammatically here with these three elements going into empowerment. And it's really the internal constraints, those associated with capacity to aspire, preferences, and the perception of one's own role, that I think are particularly powerful. And in many cases, it's right there that we need to talk when we're talking about change and promoting development. So let me develop that story just a little bit. But first, let me say something about empowerment, participation, and inclusion. I said at the beginning that those interested in empowerment, those interested in participation, those interested in inclusion would probably much of the time be talking about rather simple things. But I think actually they're conceptually different, and it's worth just recognizing the conceptual differences before we carry on and say, well, on the whole, they're pretty sympathetic, as it were, and we can often talk about these things interchangeably. First, just let me make it clear that you could address the question of empowerment in an economy where there was only Robinson Crusoe, the one-person economy. If Robinson Crusoe had a solar panel and greater imagination, then he would be more empowered. You can't address the concepts of inclusion and participation in a one-person economy. That example also makes it clear that empowerment is not necessarily a zero-sum game. In Marxist language, I think most people would see empowerment as a zero-sum game, but as I've defined it in terms of the ability to control one's own life, it's not a zero-sum game. All members of a society could together see their empowerment increase. I don't want to deny conflict, I'm just making a logical point here, that there are, I think, according to this definition, a number of interesting circumstances where everybody's empowerment can increase. There are indeed other circumstances where when one person's empowerment increases, somebody else's power or empowerment goes down, and that's also an important case. But what I want to emphasize is that we're not logically driven to that position. So empowerment encapsulates those kinds of ideas, and I think it's clear it's not the same thing as inclusion, although often the two sets of ideas would cohere. In trying to define inclusion, I go to the gurus on inclusion, a high percentage of whom are in this audience. I see John Hills and Howard Glenister here, and there the focus in inclusion is on social interaction and the act of enforcing exclusion and ways in which these characteristics persist across generations. All these things are obviously relevant for empowerment, but I think those kinds of ideas show that it's defined in a slightly different way. Now, that's crudely some of the ideas we're trying to get at when we talk about empowerment and what it means. There's always a problem of language, and one thing that I've discovered to my cost is that empowerment translates very badly into other languages. There are not that many languages in which empowerment is natural. Certainly doesn't translate very naturally into French. We've tried it into Hindi and a number of other languages. And when things don't translate very easily, you start to wonder just how strong the concepts really are. But if you talk about participation, you find a word which actually does translate quite well across other languages. As ever in LSE, there's a whole bunch of languages in the audience, so we might come back to that in the question. But I think effective participation, if you're allowed an adjective and a noun, actually for me get to much of what empowerment is about. And then you can have a discussion about what it takes to make participation effective, and you get to issues like information, accountability, and so on, which are very natural, that fit in very naturally with the whole idea of empowerment. Now, having struggled with the concept and suggested that there's some things we can do to move it on a bit, you of course say, well, how can you measure it? And again, that's a classic LSE sort of question, and rightly so. And what I've tried to do is list some of the sources which can help us get our hands on some of the elements of empowerment that I've spoken about. Usual sort of household surveys, where obviously human development outcomes are of special importance, and understanding how those human development and other outcomes are linked to social status, gender, and so on. That's one sort of source. We're getting much better with surveys of governance. I gave you some of the ideas behind the investment climate surveys, which we've been developing at the World Bank. So, and so on, you've got surveys measuring shocks and disasters. You've got the British Crime Survey, for example, which looks at victimization. And most recently, and I referred you to the World Development Report published last year on making services work for poor people, you've got a lot of data now on how public service delivery functions and what it is that makes it function well or badly. So we have got quite a rich set of data sources here. Now let me continue a bit pushing at what empowerment means, but now moving on to questions of how you change it. Now what I want to argue is that a lot of the story of changing empowerment is about changing what people want for themselves. So the process, trying to understand the process of how this changes, how what people want for themselves changes, is a crucial part of the story of development. And then we have a big policy challenge of how should we and when should we, and the legitimacy of acting to change preferences. And those are really quite difficult philosophical and practical problems. Now, sorry, let me just go back, because there's one important point I want to make here, is the distinction between preferences and behavior. If you ask most economists how we model and understand behavior for the purpose of economic analysis, they will say, well, you look at the preferences and you look at the constraints and incentives under which people operate, and you deduce their behavior from the preferences and the constraints slash incentives. Now, there is a clear relationship in that story between preferences and behavior. And clearly, if we follow this line, behavior can change with constant preferences, if information changes, or if constraints change. So to talk about change in behavior is not necessarily to introduce anything new into the economic discussion, because changes in behavior can come about, as I've said, from changes in information and changes in the constraints or incentives people face. But what I do want to argue is that when we talk about changing behavior, we should be, and I think often are, talking about much more than that. And that is something that I want to turn to now, or turn to in a moment, how we get at those kinds of changes in behavior and what it means. But let me just remind you, because I'm moving now to the story of public economics and what that adds up to. The story of public economics, which Tony Atkinson and myself and other people who were young in the 70s were working on, was very much the story of optimizing policy with fixed preferences. And you looked at ways in which, by changing taxes, changing subsidies, changing regulations, if we were getting sophisticated, could actually make either all people better off, rare, or at least give some increase in some social welfare function. That was the basic elements of the theory of public economics as we tried to drive it forward in the 70s. Now, I do not regard that youth as misspent. It's just something I would like to try to move beyond. And what I want to argue, it's rather important to move beyond it. So that is the story. Now, Milton Friedman was very clear about all this. One of the advantages of that kind of approach is it brings great clarity. Trouble is, it's whether you believe it or not is another thing. He said, I quote, "The economist has little to say about the formation of wants. This is the province of the psychologist. The economist's task is to trace the consequences of any given set of wants." Now, it's that statement with which I beg to disagree if we're trying to understand policy towards development. So let's just pursue that a little bit and ask, if we drop that assumption of constant preferences, what kinds of options do we have analytically? As I've argued, I'm not saying we throw away all that story, but I do want to say, I do want to look at, this is the story of, the standard story, if you like, I'm saying what happens if we go beyond it. So I want to argue that we have essentially two routes, two analytical routes, if we drop the assumption of constant preferences. Now, the first route is to retain the structure of formal preferences, but try to model explicitly how they change over time. And there is a literature on that, as many of you will know, literatures on addiction, literatures on learning by experience, literatures, if you like, of endogenous preferences and endogenous technologies. So we try to model the process by which preferences change. Or, alternatively, we can abandon the idea of preferences and try to focus on an empowerment-like notion where you try to understand what's changing and why it changes in terms of the ability to shape one's own life. So those are the two kinds of routes, I think, which either people have gone or should go in the positive or formal or predictive side of the story. What happens when we try to put that into policy? Now, as is clear from the description of the standard approach to public economics, which I describe, if we abandon the assumption that people know what's good for them, and if we abandon the assumption that people can recognize increases, and then, of course, base our social welfare analysis on people getting better or worse off in relative to those preferences, if we abandon that, then we have to, as it were, navigate into areas which, from the policy point of view, are rather difficult. So if we go the route of trying to model changing preferences, then I think we have to argue that we have to grapple with the idea of how you treat the two different preferences or the three different preferences that you've got. If something is better relative to the preferences of today, but worse relative to the preferences of tomorrow, how do we rate that in terms of policy? Now, that is a very hard question, but I think it's a question we do deal with. We deal with it, for example, when we talk about pensions. Right? We think that the young Besley does not treat the old Besley with sufficient sympathy and understanding, and we force him to save through the university superannuation system. Now, he may find ways of compensating for that forced saving in all sorts of clever kind of ways, and I'm sure Tim could. But essentially, we override or we rule in favour of some better set of preferences quite often. We do it in terms of tobacco and alcohol and drugs and so on. These aren't minor parts of life. Yeah? We overrule people's preferences to discriminate. So there are all kinds of ways in which we do distinguish different kinds of preferences and insist from a public policy point of view on the superiority of one set over another. So don't give me the question, I'm sure you will, but I'm advising you not to give me the question, who are you to override all this? I'm saying, well, we'd better think about it because we do it, and let's think about it carefully because it's obviously a very important part of public policy. Now, the second route is to try to, as I've said, identify expansions of the ability to shape your own life and argue that those expansions are good things because we're trying to promote empowerment and then promote those. So those are logically two different routes to prediction and logically two different routes to policy. And I think it's clear from what I've already said that both routes will not give you the clarity of answer of our standard public economics. That's a great virtue in the standard public economics. It does give you clear answers. But if we go down these routes, we're not going to be able to expect the kind of clarity, and we are going to have to expect some ambiguities. Now, let me accelerate a bit because we want to have time for questions. But why is all this important? And let me just give you one or two examples. Essentially, through pensions and so on, I've given you some examples already. But let me refer you to a remarkable book by Richard Tawney, Land and Labour in China, which he wrote after visiting China in 1930. He said, "The movement to industrialization is a growing force. Where it directly affects, for better or worse, the livelihood of one, it indirectly modifies the habits of ten. Its effect on the mind is ultimately more important than its visible embodiment in mills and mines." Let me give you another example, which is changing standards in the economic in economic transitions. As Tim said, I worked as chief economist for the EBRD through a large part of the 1990s and watched the traumas unfolding in Russia and other parts of the former Soviet Union. I believe that in those societies you did see dramatic changes in preferences. People's view of right and wrong, people's view of acceptable behaviour, people's view about what they should do, people's views about their own actions, I think changed quite dramatically in that period. And my own view is that was in large part because of the behaviour of the leadership and the wholesale grabbing of the state, which people saw, and I believe that that experience directly changed the way in which they behaved. I can't prove it according to the usual economist's standard of evidence, but that seemed to me to be a very important example. We've seen how in the Second World War, for example, attitudes to women in the labour force changed dramatically. When my mother died about a little over 10 years ago, we were going through some of her papers, and I found that when she went into the civil service just after the war, there was a letter to her saying that she was being offered the highest grade open to a married woman. And we now think that's sort of slightly quaint and a bit funny and totally odd, but this in my view is an important example of the kinds of ways experience change preferences, because it was the experience of the Second World War, which I think was very important, the dramatic increase in women in the labour force, which helped to break down those kinds of attitudes. So, and lastly, let me draw attention to what I think is an example of enormous importance in developing countries, and that's the education of girls. In large measure, in many developing countries, the challenge to educating girls is changing the preferences of the fathers. It's not simply giving them information about how much better off their daughters will be. I think it's actually persuading them that there's a different kind of life out there, and that different kind of life is something that they should want for their daughters. And I think that in many cases it's right there, changing attitudes of fathers, that is crucial to education of girls. So I've tried to give examples which I think, which for me in any case, point to the centrality of changing preferences in the development story. It isn't a marginal thing. Now, I'll accelerate a little bit here. There are all kinds of problems when you try to make these ideas practical. I've already mentioned distinguishing preferences from information, and of course you've got very strong two-way causation, where changing preferences change economic conditions, and changing economic conditions change preferences. So drawing evidence here is going to be very powerful. And I've already raised the issues of what kinds of judgments that we bring to the table. Now, and I've already anticipated some of what I have to say in this story. But I find I don't have to accelerate because I've anticipated myself in a number of ways. Now, let me go on then to try to give a bit more meat to the idea of policy. I've tried to define the ideas, tried to argue their importance, I've tried to draw attention to the analytical challenges that we hit when we try to turn them into substance, and let's now just go on putting some of those difficulties to one side and see what happens when we try to discuss policies. So we try to discuss policies that I've argued, in two ways. I don't find the explicit modelling of preferences all that a preference change, all that productive from the point of view of welfare economics or the economics of policy. But that's maybe something that we can argue about when we come to questions. What I want to do is to talk about how you go after the idea of changing preferences and what's involved and what are some of the challenges. Now, I think that if you turn to the political philosophers, you will find already some of them talking exactly in the kinds of terms that I've been describing. When Nozick writes from his particular perspective, what he's doing is asserting essentially inviolable freedoms. Freedoms to act in markets, freedoms to get the returns from your endowments and so on. And he's thinking, I think, very much in terms of empowerment and from a rights kind of approach, certain empowerments that cannot be infringed. I think Isaiah Berlin comes at it also with a much more liberal view in many ways than Nozick. But he also comes at it in this kind of way when he's insisting on, he talks about states, governments and policies in terms of liberty. So what I wanted to do here is to say that if we come at it from the kind of direction that I've come at it, we should recognize that in some ways we're straying onto the ground or covering the same kind of ground that political philosophers have raised when they talk about rights and liberties, but we're doing it in a slightly more incrementalist way by talking about empowerment, which is expansion of the ideas. The political philosophers tend to come at it from the point of view of what empowerments or what liberties are sacrosanct and what should not be infringed, or in the case of Berlin, how you put different notions of liberty together. But they are talking about the same kinds of things as we're talking about here. Now, let me come to an end of what I want to say about the policies here by talking about the kinds of actions that you can take. What kinds of policies would follow from the kind of approach that I've adopted here? Well, of course, we have to ask ourselves about the validity of the kinds of policies which we might look at. And let me just give you two examples here to show you the kinds of things that can take us to direct action here on applying the idea of empowerment. And what we do is, instead of focusing only on policies and outcomes, we focus on the kinds of processes which can deliver, or which might be taken to deliver, expansions in empowerment. So first, let me just give you these two examples. One is Ait Iqtel, which is a village in the High Atlas in Morocco. And I haven't got the time to go into the story at length, but we could talk about it perhaps afterwards. What happened is that there were two people from this village, it was a very poor village, who came back because there's tremendous drought in the village, and what they wanted to do is to try to bring some security of water supply. So what they did is got people together using their family contacts and the village structures, and managed to promote the digging and construction of a well. People saw the returns to direct action, and they went on to build access roads, they went on to build schools, and so on. And the whole structure and society and the way in which people got together to do things, their whole receptiveness to outside concepts changed. And let me just give you a second example, and this has to do with AIDS in Calcutta. Previously, the policy had been in large measure on AIDS to try to persuade sex workers, Sunagachi is a red light district in Calcutta, to try to persuade sex workers to leave the industry. Not surprisingly, it was a policy which failed fairly miserably. But what they then did is found a few sympathetic sex workers in the red light district in Sunagachi and tried to gain their trust and talk through with them their problems. Those sex workers then worked directly with other sex workers on the use of condoms. And what happened was, in a fairly short period of time, between 92 and 99, HIV incidence in Sunagachi was 6% compared to 50% in other red light districts, including those in Mumbai. So a really dramatic change in both cases from people working within a society to get changes in behavior, collaborative behavior, introduction of outside ideas, use of condoms, and so on. And it turned out in these cases that the process, the interaction, the way in which people spoke to each other, who it was that was speaking to them, were actually enormously important in the shaping of policy. So that's thinking about the way these social processes work in order to actually bring about changes in behavior through changes in preferences and changes in outcomes. So I think that if we go down this route, it's not empty. There are actually quite a lot of things that it points to, and it points to changing preferences through social interaction. Now, that again is a set of ideas that has a rich tradition. If you read John Stuart Mill on representative government, he was talking about voting in terms and participation in political process in terms of the changing in ideas, that the interactions that you have in the political process changes what you think, changes your set of preferences, changes your thoughts about what's good and what's bad for you and for others. John Elster, more recently, another political philosopher of great distinction, as many of you know, he spoke about the democratic process as having at its core the transformation of preferences by public discussion rather than the isolated act of voting according to private fixed preferences. In other words, he was rejecting, as it were, the arrow social welfare function approach to the analysis of democracy and arguing that we should replace it by trying to understand the way in which preferences change through the process of interaction. It's a story that goes, as I've said, to de Tocqueville and John Stuart Mill. So I think that if we push these ideas, we not only get specific examples for action of the kind that I gave you from Morocco and Calcutta, but we also link ourselves back to some of the political philosophers in the past who've actually seen a lot of the story in this kind of way. So let me draw these thoughts to a conclusion. I've tried to argue that development is a story of fundamental change in structures of society, and where many parts of that change can be understood only in terms of people changing preferences. And secondly, I've argued that looking at development as a process of change leads us to a strategy where empowering and investing in people is a big part of the story. If you then pursue that strategy, I've tried to argue that you get into something which builds on, that goes beyond the standard public economics that we have, but I think it also tells us something about the reality of policy and how we can make things work. Now, I've said a lot about changing institutions, changing governance, changing behavior. there are a number of ways of thinking about how you might do that. I just note that for another lecture. And should I ever be invited again, I would like to talk about how you actually change institutions and governance in the context of what I've said about changing behaviour, because I think they're very much wrapped together. So finally, I think that if we follow through on this story, we'll get something that genuinely enriches the kind of public policy which Tony Atkinson and Mervyn King and myself were engaged on when we had our research programme on taxation distribution, taxation incentives and the distribution of income in the LSE in the late 80s and early 90s. We had a set of constructs there which I still feel very comfortable with, but the experience of working on development has also led me to believe that we have to go beyond that. And if you ask yourself, and this is very much a stickered way to end, if you ask yourself what kinds of ideas have I drawn on today, well, essentially they've been economics, anthropology, political philosophy, social administration. But law, geography and sociology have also come in to what I've had to say. So I hope pointing to the way in which these sets of ideas come in from different strands of the social sciences is a very stickered way to end, and perhaps emphasizes why Michio Morishima, in his wisdom, insisted that it was the International Center for Economics and, I stress here, related disciplines. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nick. As Nick hinted throughout, he was willing to take questions at this point, so we have about 5 or 10 minutes for questions, if there are any. And Nick, are you happy to regulate that from the podium? Otherwise, I can play a role, but it's better perhaps.
At the back there.
I wonder whether you could reflect back on the situation in sub-Saharan Africa in relation to empowerment. Is there a problem of lack of empowerment there, which could explain some of the statistics that you put up at the beginning?
Well, I think the extreme example of conflict is a case in which people's control over their own lives is absolutely destroyed. And I think if you look over the last 20, 25 years in Africa, conflict has been a big part of that story. And you may or may not know that Paul Collier, who's a professor of economics at Oxford, recently published a book on the causes of conflict and traced much of that, and it's quite a sophisticated argument, but he traced much of that to natural resources and to poverty itself, and he builds up an explanation of why it is that those work in the way that they do. And he uses data. Sadly, there's lots and lots of observations in this data set. He uses data on civil wars over the last 50 or so years, many, far from all of course, but many of which have been in Africa. So I think it's an example where the catastrophe is in very large measure a catastrophe of empowerment, and where we have some grip, or starting to get some grip, on what the causes of those catastrophes are. I think that the issue of governance more generally in sub-Saharan Africa is absolutely central to understanding how public sector works, how its interaction with the private sector works. So I think that these stories are at the heart of much of development, including sub-Saharan Africa. Yeah.
Following on from that question, I'm a teacher who did some urban geography here. A lot of the women I teach are care assistants and come from the bottom end pay-wise of the NHS, and they're being trained to become nurses, to go to college and become nurses. A lot of those people send some money back to, say, West Africa, and are learning all sorts of things by being trained, and then go on to the NHS. Is there any way a lot of them have come because of conflict as well. Is there any way that sort of cohort, with their particular knowledge both of Africa and their increasing knowledge of the NHS and the peripheral areas of empowerment can be further empowered as a kind of bridging community to deliver aid, information, whatever, in more particular ways than my own experiences of Ghana, where I did from time to time observe corruption on a large scale. Is there any way of using these sort of capillaries in a way of a kind of reciprocal empowerment, but particularly back to West Africa?
Yes, the example I gave of Morocco, the village in the High Atlas, they were two people who'd left the village. In their case, they hadn't emigrated out of Morocco, but essentially they'd gone to work in towns. And they came back both with resources and ideas and were able to get a social process of change going, where their own preferences and ideas had changed, and they were able to bring some of these back to the village with, I think, with a little bit of resource that went with them. But if you look at remittances as a whole, from rich countries to poor countries, are now running around $80 billion a year. Aid runs at about $50 billion a year. Foreign direct investment, maybe $140, $150 billion a year. So you can see that remittances are somewhere between aid and FDI in terms of capital flows into developing countries. They're of enormous importance and of rising importance. And the way in which those remittances are used depends enormously on the kind of environment into which they come. And if it's an environment where, to use the language I was using earlier, the investment climate is positive, where small farmers have incentives to invest in their land, where they can, as it were, sow with some kind of confidence that they'll be able to reap, then you can see very productive investments taking place. In other circumstances, if the investment climate is less strong, you see less in the way of remittances and you see less productive use of remittances. So I think the kinds of constraints on behavior, the kind of understandings of what people themselves are capable of, which is the empowerment story, are indeed very important determinants of the value of remittances. But I think we're learning more and more, because these are accelerating while other forms of finance are not accelerating, I think we're learning more and more that they should have a powerful role in our whole understanding, not only of resource flows, but in the way in which resource flows function.
You said a little bit about the need to have some normative view about, in a context of changing preferences, about which kind of preferences we think are good and which kind of preferences we think are bad. So in a public policy perspective, which preferences to subsidize and which one to tax. So my question is the following. In a political economy perspective, in a democratic setting, which kind of majority should decide on this kind of stuff? Should this be done at the constitutional level, or can it be done at the ordinary level?
I think my answer to that would come back to political processes. I don't want to sit here and say I'm from the World Bank. I'm not anymore, of course, but were I to have given it a year ago, I'm from the World Bank, I've come to change your preferences. I think that would be treated with the derision it would deserve. On the other hand, I've said that we can't walk away from these kinds of questions. And we can't. I mean, the examples I've given are pretty obvious that we don't, at least, walk away from these kinds of things. But I would point to the political processes. The kinds of preferences that you want to come out in favour of would be the kind of preferences that have come out of political interaction and political discussion. And I'd place more emphasis on that than on straight voting. I agree that governments take decisions and governments in democracies are elected. So ultimately, there will be decisions based in the kind of way you described. But I'd place special emphasis on the process. I mean, if you think back to homosexual law reform in the 1960s, public discussion built up, and a government acted probably marginally ahead of public opinion. So you had a process of interaction, discussion, leadership, political action, and now I think we'd all, I think, can see that that preferences in terms of attitudes have changed dramatically in a 30 or 40 year period. So these are the kinds of interactions which I think, and processes which are important. It will be discussion, voting, sometimes being ahead of the game, but it's those kinds of processes which I think are what we should look to for some kind of notion of which preferences are better than others, rather than just saying that it should be John Stuart Mill or Confucius or Socrates who should rule on these things. I think it's the process of interaction that's most important. Atta.
Yeah, I think taking out from last suggestion, let me just ask, what is the role of religion in these attitudes? Because this is both a topical issue and refers back to the famous classic by Max Weber, Protestant Ethic and Development of Capitalism. So I'm just asking, where would religion come in all this?
Thank you, I think that it comes in a number of ways. I mean, it comes in clearly in terms of derivation of values, and the values that people have in the kind of language we use in economics are quite closely associated with the preferences that they have. And it seems to me a perfectly understandable, legitimate source of values and preferences. There are many cases where a lot of interaction about preferences and values takes place within discussion in religious groups, and that seems to me the kind of discussion and interaction I was pointing to. It's probably also clear in the kind of way I was approaching it and my reverence for Isaiah Berlin that I would place a strong emphasis on tolerance in those environments, but I'm bringing obviously my own preferences into that story. So I think that you have to recognize that religion plays a very powerful role. You wouldn't want to really, if you think of the fact that religious-based schools in Africa educate about half the population, in Pakistan it would be pretty high also, and preferences are formed in large measure in terms of schools. So we have to understand well, or try to understand, the way in which religion comes into it, and see it as actually a big shaping part of the discourse.
We have time for one more.
Max.
Thank you. Nick, you spoke favorably about De Soto, and so did President Bill Clinton when he spoke on this stage a couple of years ago, and I find it a bit mysterious. I mean, De Soto says that if people in low-income countries had more secure property rights in their homes, they could use their homes as collateral and borrow, and this would lead to great economic growth. What I am a bit mystified about is, are they expected to borrow from each other or from abroad? And who is going to foreclose on these homes if people are unable to meet these payments? In other words, will this collateral really give empowerment, which is what De Soto seems to feel?
I did refer briefly to De Soto, but I didn't give that reason, and I think he overstresses it. But what I was thinking of, and what I think is extremely important, is investment in your own land, in agriculture, and investment in your own house. And people around the world, if they get a bit more money, it doesn't matter where you are, they put it into the house. The village in Palanpur, where I lived and worked for those years and have been visiting for 30 years, if people get a bit of money, they change, well, they get a table or a bicycle, or they change from a mud hut to a brick from Kacha to Paka. And these are investing in what it is that's important in their lives, creating environments where their families can flourish more easily. Similarly, if you look at people's investment in their own land, if they're secure in their own land, then they will build terraces, they'll sink wells, and so on. If their cattle are secure from theft or some questions about ownership, they will invest more in looking after them. So for me, the story about property rights isn't so much the collateral story for the skepticism that reasons associated with the skepticism which you described. It's about people, as it were, feeling secure in changing their own lives and reshaping what they can do. And I think property rights are very important in that story. You used the word twice in your question, mystery, I think, and it was a rotten title of the book. Many of you, I'm sure, would have read De Soto's book, The Mystery of Capital, and the thing he was pointing to wasn't mysterious at all. It was standard property rights. But the fact that he overblew it, and the fact that he chose a rotten title, doesn't seem to me to detract from the importance of the idea. But of course, I do accept the criticism. I didn't need to refer to De Soto to underline the importance of property rights.
Nick, it just remains for me to bring matters to a close and to thank you for a very interesting lecture. I think we can all take comfort in the fact that our public servants now have such important intellectual contributions to make as well as practical contributions. And as I say, Nick was the embodiment and is the embodiment of the values of Sticker, both interdisciplinary and high quality cutting edge thinking. Thank you very much, Nick. We've all learned a great deal.
Thank you.